We'll hear arguments next in 6528, Burks against the state, the United States. You may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case arose in Nashville, Tennessee. It was a bank robbery which occurred there some 2 years ago. The defendant, at his arraignment, interposed a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. At that time in the Sixth Circuit, we were operating under the Smith Rule, which we presently are today, known as Smith 1. The case decided in 1968. The defendant, as I said, entered a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity, and on motion of the government, he was ordered to be examined for mental competency. The order of the district court, which required him to be examined, set out the three rules which the Sixth Circuit, which uses the ALI rule, basically requires, and ordered the physician to report to the court and the United States attorney the answers to those questions. Trial came on sometime later, and the issue was contested on the facts at the trial, but of the trial transcript, almost the bulk of it, if not probably the bulk, is consumed with the really the only defense, and that is insanity. The United States used a psychiatrist and a psychologist as their witnesses. They also used lay persons in the bank and a cab driver who was kidnapped just before the robbery for a few moments. And as I said, they used the lay witnesses in the bank, and they used the FBI agents who apprehended him just a few moments and took after the bank robbery and made the arrest. The defendant used as his experts the family of the defendant, who testified to bizarre, erratic, and unusual behavior, and three medical witnesses, two highly qualified psychiatrists, one of whom had been used, Dr. Munden, who had been used many times by the United States as their choice to examine potential defendants interposing insanity defenses.
Are you suggesting that we can inquire into or try to reevaluate the qualifications of the expert witnesses?
No, sir. My point is just saying that there were five medical expert witnesses, and it was extensively presented to the trial court. The United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit looked into that matter, and they reversed the case under the authority of 28. USC 2106, the federal statute, which empowers this court and the courts of appeal to enter such orders as are just and appropriate. The Sixth Circuit, in my opinion, made a finding of fact that the government did not make a prima facie case. Counsel for the United States has raised the question of whether, raised by the members of the court a few minutes earlier, as to whether the government made a prima facie case, or to what extent one might read that opinion of the Sixth Circuit. But in any event, they found that because of insufficient evidence, the case should be remanded. The Sixth Circuit cited the Bryan Rule, which has been discussed today. As your honors know, and as I've set out, there was no criminal appeal, except in extraordinary cases, until 1890-something, and then, I believe, only in capital cases. And in 1896, the Ball Rule came forth, which was an attack on double jeopardy, and it's the leading case in that, and set forth the rule of waiver, in which it was said that sometimes someone who got a new trial had was either starting on a clean slate or that there was continuing jeopardy or that by asking for a new trial he had waived it. And much of my brief is taken up with rebutting the waiver rationale in light of this court's later opinions, and particularly in light of the Green decision of this court. And I believe the Solicitor General's brief, a fair reading of that, is that he pretty much agrees with me that waiver is not an issue. With respect to a waiver where one specifically asked for a new trial as well as a judgment of acquittal, which was a question asked some time ago, I would only say that any defendant would rather have an acquittal rather than a new trial. If that's the only choice with which he's faced, then it's no choice at all. And whereas in this case, we asked the district judge both for a new trial. We filed a motion for a new trial alleging other errors.
What about the choice between a new trial and a judgment of conviction?
A new trial and a judgment of conviction, that's one which the defendant might, on appropriate occasions, prefer a judgment of conviction in light of Chaffin v. Steinkrohm and some of the cases this court has decided that he might get more time on the second.
Well, supposing you move for a in the trial court, you move for a judgment of acquittal on insufficiency of the evidence, move for a new trial on the ground it's against the weight of the evidence or whatever the rule may provide. Your motion for judgment of acquittal is denied. Your motion for a new trial is granted. Do you think that at the commencement of that second trial, you can then raise a double jeopardy claim?
No, sir.
Why not?
Well, assuming it was denied, it would, assuming it was spelled out, if you were denying it.
Supposing it's just a minute order of the trial judge, motion for judgment, NOV, denied, motion for new trial, granted on the grounds of against the weight of the evidence.
No, sir, I don't think you could. I think the only, you'd be limited to that, to where it was clear that, where it went to the question of the sufficiency of the evidence. And if it was just a minute order, I don't think you would have enough of a record, really.
Well, he's being tried a second time for the same offense. How can that be done under the double jeopardy clause?
Well, it's one of the exceptions that I don't think one must bring oneself within the exceptions, and I don't think that one properly has in that instance. Bryan versus United States was what I believe to be the first considered opinion. It was decided in 1950 by this court. As I point out, it was a 12-paragraph decision. It was decided a few months or within a short time after the new rules of federal criminal procedure were adopted, and it was primarily concerned, in my judgment, with the application of the rules that involve the district court vis-a-vis the power of the Court of Appeals. And the court did have language in there and did say in the final paragraph that it does not violate the double jeopardy provision of the United States Constitution to retry a man the second time for insufficient evidence. Subsequent to 1950 in the Bryan case, it has been the subject of nothing but uncomplimentary articles, both in the courts, discussions in the courts, and in the law review articles, to the fact that Bryan was wrongly decided. And if I read the brief of the United States fairly, I believe that they are willing to give a great deal on Bryan, although they're not, of course, willing to give all. In fact, if I read the brief fairly for the United States, I can almost make the argument that they're willing to give this case, but they're not but they wish to urge to the court that not be the Bryan overruling, if such be the case, not be extended to all cases where the evidence is insufficient to support the verdict. The reasons advanced for double jeopardy occurring where the evidence is insufficient to support the verdict have been numerous. Since 1950, I think we've seen an increase in decisions on double jeopardy. Double jeopardy is a hierarchy of rights, has taken a stronger position. Some of the reasons which I would urge on the court why this distinction should be allowed would be as follows. Before I get to that, let me point out the difference between reversals for procedural errors and reversals for insufficient evidence. Where the case is reversed for a procedural error, the defendant did not get the trial of which he was entitled. The prosecutor made some remark that was wrong. A statement was introduced against him which was not reliably probative, or some other reason. And so we have a great, heretofore, it seems to me, unrecognized quantum difference between a reversal for a procedural error, such as even in Bryan, where the two cases it cited involved those type of cases. We have a quantum difference.
By procedural error, do you mean trial error generally? Trial error as distinguished from insufficiency of the evidence?
I mean any other error other than just failure of the state to sufficiently.
Would there be any other kinds? Two categories?
I'm sorry.
Are there any other kinds of errors that could be raised on appeal other than either errors in the trial or insufficient evidence to support the verdict?
No, sir.
How about a defective indictment?
Yes, sir. Pretrial errors of defective indictment, statute of limitations, some of those
defective
errors.
Defective grand jury?
Yes, sir.
So it could be pretrial errors as well.
Yes, sir. In one category, I think we put all errors involving sufficiency of the evidence. In the other, in box B, we put everything else. And I think it's readily ascertainable, the quantum, as I've said, difference between the two. Now, as I said, this court has never given, as far as I know, plenary consideration or even discussed that difference until today. Now, some of the arguments in favor of granting acquittals after insufficient evidence have to do with the disparity of treatment which the same defendant might receive. For example, other trial courts, let's assume that the evidence is insufficient to support the verdict. Trial Court A might affirm, as we've heard here in the case from Florida, another judge sitting might grant a new trial on the same proof. And also other appellate courts, two different panels of appellate courts might grant acquittals. In the Sixth Circuit, in a case I've cited in my brief, Rosenberger, the Court of Appeals, one panel sent the case back a few years ago for ordered a judgment of acquittal. In the present case before you today, they sent it back for a new trial. And then you have different standards. The case was sent back today under a Fifth Circuit standard. In other instances, the standard has been, rather than what's just and appropriate, sometimes like in the Wiley case or some of the other cases that have been mentioned, they've been sent back as to whether or not the prosecution was unfairly prevented from bringing evidence. So one has people being either sent, cases either being sent back or not sent back, and of those that are sent back, then we have different standards for that. So we almost have a lawless, as Mr. Justice Stevens pointed out, or the question suggested to me, and in many ways we have a lawless system of appellate review. We're standardless. Furthermore, there's an argument that the idea of allowing the government two bites at the apple in instances of insufficient evidence condones and perpetuates careless prosecutorial trial and preparation. And I believe a fair reading of the record would show that that's true in this instance. In this instance, it seems egregious. Number one, it was a plea of not guilty, quote, by reason of insanity, close quote, in minute entry and orally in court. So they were advised at arraignment what it would be. Number two, the judge's order to determine competency set out the three rules of Smith. Number three, the defense at trial, of course, had to raise the issue of insanity first, and they asked every witness. They went right down the Smith rule in the Sixth Circuit. Furthermore, the record shows we had large charts in which we asked each witness, what's your answer to question one, question two, and question three? And lastly, the court in its charge to the jury followed that. The Smith case, as I say, was decided in 1968. Smith 2, which went into an amplified Smith 1, which was the same defendant back on a retrial, on a subsequent appeal after a retrial, went into the question of the quantum of proof. What was the evidentiary value of lay witnesses? And I think that this is an instance, and we're not suggesting that the prosecutor has to bam, 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 one, two, three, ask the ALI questions or the Smith and our circuit questions. But he's got to some way elicit the ultimate facts of that. And he failed to do that. He used the type of witnesses who the Sixth Circuit had already told him did not have proper credentials. In that 1970 opinion, they said someone who just sees the crime for a few minutes and described the witnesses that the government used, that those type of people don't have sufficient knowledge to for the trier of fact to reach the ultimate issue. Now, society, of course, should fear, and the Tateo case and the Wilson case decided a term or two ago by this court, urge a balancing of the equities. But that's not the instance in insufficient evidence cases. You know, society should fear the release of a defendant acquitted on a procedural error, because we make a judgment there that it is better, perhaps, to uphold a principle to let one man go for that reason than it is to insist upon a conviction. Well, one of the striking examples of that, of course, was this court's opinion not long ago, perhaps I think last term, a case out of Arizona where the young man had given, where the defendant had murdered a child and given a confession to a police officer driving back. But yet we made a decision that it was better that that be suppressed, and perhaps that defendant may have been ultimately released as a societal balancing of the interest. But that's not true in the present case because, as I say, we have no interest in keeping a man where the evidence was insufficient to convict him. Forget the double jeopardy clause and all it means for a moment. Why society has no interest where a court of appeals has looked at the proof, everything there, and has found that the government has not made a case against the man. And furthermore, there's no difference between raising the issue of insufficient evidence at trial and on appeal. I think this rule would conserve judicial energy, the rule I urge, in that sometimes trial judges may let cases go on appeal thinking that the appellate courts might sort all this out, whereas the defense counsel and trial lawyers should perhaps be more diligent in doing that. Now, injustice can be exacerbated when the defendant cannot make bond. In the present case, for example, the defendant has not made bond, and in many other cases, I suspect.
What do you think underlies the federal rule that you disagree with?
What underlies?
What kind of a policy or a judgment underlies or justifies the federal rule? Bryan, for example.
If you restrict it to retrials for insufficiency of evidence, I think one can make an argument that appellate courts get a feel that this man is probably guilty and that it's in the interest of, without any enunciated criteria, they get a feeling that he should be retried.
Do you think the federal rule is representative of most state practices or not?
Yes,
or do you know?
I think that in most practices, that historically there's been no differentiation between, just as in the federal courts, as between reversals for procedural as opposed to reversals for insufficiency of the evidence.
So you are suggesting that we, on a constitutional basis, invalidate a rather wide majority of state rules, too?
I don't think that it's ever been considered, and it comes up that often, but it's... I would urge this court rule on a constitutional basis,
yeah.
Firstly, and secondly, I would urge it rule on the statutory basis and under its supervisory powers over the lower federal courts under the facts of this case, under Section 2106.
I see that's an abuse of
Society has no interest in retrying no evidence cases. The time that is
Let me see if I understand you. On the statutory basis, you mean by holding that this it was an abuse of discretion to say that this was an appropriate order of the Court of Appeals on the facts situation here, is that it?
Yes, sir. I think you could look at the Sixth Circuit and say they've done two or three different things with the different cases. The Rosenberg case I cited in my brief, in this case, one they acquitted, one they did not. I cite an Illinois case from the Illinois Bar Journal article in which the commentator makes it, the motion, makes the point that in a rape case out of Illinois, two men, two separate times, committed rape. The one didn't match up to the corroborative rule, the other did. So they sent one back for a retrial and they acquitted one. Thank you, Your Honor.
You're making essentially the same argument that was made in the preceding case, which you heard, that confronted with this situation, an appellate court has just two choices, affirm or reverse, and that there are no other alternatives.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Easterbrook.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, at least since 1896, when United States against Ball was decided, it has been settled that the Double Jeopardy Clause imposes no limitations on the power to retry a defendant who, after being convicted at trial, succeeds in having his conviction set aside. The principle is as old as the Double Jeopardy Clause, and this Court applied it in the Bryan case to reversals for insufficient evidence. Bryan squarely controls this case, and in our view, the open question is whether and to what extent Bryan should be reexamined. Petitioner here, like petitioner in the preceding case, invokes a syllogism. It runs like this. One, if the evidence is insufficient to support a conviction, the court should grant a judgment of acquittal without submitting the case to the jury. Two, if the trial judge grants such a judgment of acquittal, the Double Jeopardy Clause bars a second trial. Three, a reversal on appeal because of insufficient evidence amounts to a determination by the Court of Appeals that the trial judge should have granted that motion. Four, since what should have been done ought to be treated as if it had been done, this case should be treated as if the judge had granted the judgment of acquittal and the Double Jeopardy Clause therefore bars another trial.
You would agree, would you, with the soundness of the first three premises, says, but not with the conclusion, is that it?
We have in the past taken issue with the soundness of that second premise. We took issue with it in Martin Linen, and Mr. Justice Rehnquist argued in the Lee case that a decision by the judge should be treated the same as a dismissal of the indictment. But that's been settled by Martin Linen.
Right.
For the purpose of this case, we take issue with the conclusion and the part of the fourth premise that is a conclusion rather than a premise.
But not with the first three premises.
That's right. We think the syllogism suffers from excessive attention to form. The rule that an acquittal by the judge is final and that the Double Jeopardy Clause bars a second trial is justified as a means to protect the ability of the defendant to receive a verdict of the jury and to protect his interest in an acquittal that he actually obtains. But it requires a leap to say that a person who was not acquitted at trial deserves the same treatment. This case does not require speculation about what a jury would have been done if given the chance. It was given the chance, and it returned a verdict of guilty. This case does not involve the defendant's interest in preserving a disposition in his favor.
Do you think this case is involving, as it does, the weight of the evidence on his criminal responsibility is any different from the weight of the evidence on presence at the scene of the crime or any other element of the crime?
We believe it is, Your Honor. This is a case in which the prosecutor presented a prima facie case that the defendant robbed the bank. And indeed, on appeal, the defendant conceded that he robbed the bank. All of the testimony that his psychiatrist gave explained why he robbed the bank, what internal compulsion drove him to become a bank robber. We believe that this, for that reason, this case falls well within the argument of Tateo, that there's a category of cases in which the public has an interest in avoiding seeing those who are actually guilty of crime go free because of an error made at trial.
Tateo was doing the trial, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, it was. Defendant pleaded guilty during the trial of Tateo.
A person who is insane cannot be guilty of a crime.
That's true, and in that sense, ultimately, sanity is an element of the offense. And
well, absolutely.
It was so.
There cannot be guilt on the part of the person who is insane. One may argue about the definition of insanity, but putting that to one side, a person who is insane cannot be guilty of a criminal offense. You would agree with that one?
I agree with that one.
On what basis do you agree? Was that as a statutory matter or a common law matter, constitutional?
It's a common law matter in the federal courts. The decision of this court in the Davis case was that as a matter of federal common law, sanity is part of the offense. But in federal cases, the usual order of proof is proof of the commission of the offense, then the defendant's proof of sanity, of insanity, and then the prosecutor's experts will then
take
the stand.
Well, then you're still standing on your response to my prior question that there is a difference?
There is at least for constitutional purposes, Mr. Chief Justice. The court held in Leland against Oregon that as a constitutional matter, sanity need not be part of the offense, and that the defendant can be required to prove lack of sanity. For that purpose, there's a difference between those elements of the offense that the Constitution requires to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and that includes the fact that a petitioner robbed the bank, and those elements that the Constitution does not require to be so proven, and that the defendant, indeed, could be required constitutionally
burden
to prove.
Burden of proof is something else. I think you've already said, but let me be sure that I understand it, that you would concede, would you not, that an insane person cannot be guilty of a criminal offense if he's insane at the time of the conduct, which for on the part of a sane person would be a criminal offense?
Yes, Your Honor. But my answer to the Chief Justice's question may be more easily understood once I've established some of the premises of my argument. I'd like to turn back in that direction. I was trying to discuss the reasons why an actual acquittal at trial has been thought to deserve a special rule of finality. My point then was that petitioner was actually not acquitted at trial. He had no interest in that sort of finality that he was seeking to preserve. In fact, this is a case in which the judge and all 12 jurors concluded that his sanity had been proven beyond a reasonable doubt on the evidence that they heard. Petitioner's argument rests on a form of symmetry. If I had been acquitted, I couldn't be retried. Since I should have been acquitted, I shouldn't be retried. But the argument from symmetry is weak because it slights the reasons for giving special force to an acquittal that actually took place. And it slights the rule that reversals on appeal of a conviction at trial always have been treated differently. It's hard to see why a non-obvious defect in the evidence, a defect so subtle that it was missed by the prosecutor, by the judge, and by all 12 jurors, should confer automatic immunity from prosecution.
But this case didn't say anything. This case said insufficiency of the evidence.
Your Honor.
And that's not like forgetting to show that the man was 8 years old.
Your Honor, the Court of Appeals did say that the evidence was insufficient.
No, they did more. That was the basis of the ruling, wasn't it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Wasn't that the basis of the ruling? Of their ruling?
The decision of the Court of Appeals was that the evidence of sanity was insufficient.
Yeah.
It's sometimes necessary, we think, in cases like this, to determine what the Court meant by that. As Judge Leventhal said in the Wiley case, on which we have relied heavily in our brief, courts of appeals sometimes use language of insufficiency when they mean something else. The Court of Appeals might have meant two somethings else in this case. The first something else it might have meant was that the prosecutor should have asked his expert witnesses, point blank, the question whether the defendant was substantially capable of conforming his conduct to the requirements of the law. And not having asked that question point blank and gotten an answer, he hadn't put on a form of evidence that the Court of Appeals wants in insanity cases. But that might not mean that the jury was proscribed from inferring from the other things those psychiatrists said how they would have answered that question if it had been asked.
But, Mr. Easterbrook, under the Glasser rule, shouldn't the evidence have been taken most favorably to support the verdict, and therefore wouldn't the appellate court have a duty to assume that the jury did make the inference if that was a permissible inference?
I think, Mr. Justice Stevens, that the evidence should have been so taken, and indeed there is a strong argument that the Court of Appeals in this case was wrong in its evaluation of the evidence, precisely because...
But you didn't cross-petition.
So we did not cross-petition, and we did not raise it as an argument in support of the judgment.
So then don't we have to take the case as though the Court of Appeals held the evidence was insufficient?
I understand that we do. My point in making this point was that even taking the case that way, there are many varieties of insufficiency of the evidence. It comes in different shapes and colors. And it's not all the same as if the prosecutor, for an unexplained reason, had simply neglected to prove that the defendant robbed the bank. The other way to put this, I think...
No. I just say I don't really understand your example, because if we assume, in accordance with Glasser, that the jury did draw all the inferences favorable to the government that it could have drawn, and the Court of Appeals nevertheless found the evidence insufficient, why is this different from the last case, for example?
I might try the answer in a slightly different way. Wherever you draw the line between sufficiency of the evidence and insufficiency of the evidence, some cases are going to be very close to that line on either side. The Court of Appeals is confronted with a very difficult question when it gets that kind of case. If it has two alternatives and two alternatives only, reversing the conviction outright and discharging the defendant on the one hand, and affirming the conviction outright on the other hand, it may be influenced in making its decision, as the Court said in Tateo, by the fact that it believes that there's been a prima facie case of guilt, that the technical insufficiency of the evidence is really not enough to bar a conviction of someone who, in the Court's view, is actually guilty. If it views the case that way, it may be inclined to err on the side of affirmance, if it has only two options.
It would have a duty to affirm.
It would have the duty.
Now, how can you say then it's erring on the side of affirmance? It's just performing
The question is how it resolves doubt. There is doubt in many of these cases, and some rules are necessary for resolving it. If it
this
ends
is
up resolving...
This is on direct
appeal. If it ends up resolving doubt in those kinds of cases in favor of affirmance, that's a rule that's probably not beneficial for defendants as a group.
No, but isn't it beneficial for...
Is that the appropriate inquiry for us, whether the rule is, in the long run, going to be helpful or harmful?
One of the concerns, and one that I think is important, is how the Court of Appeals is going to deal with the cases in which it has substantial doubt, in which it finds itself on the razor's edge between conviction and outright dismissal of the charges. The point I was trying to make is that a remand for a second trial in that class of cases offers the Court of Appeals and defendants as a group an attractive option that avoids the great dilemma that it might otherwise be in.
But why is it so clear that that's an attractive option? If you remand in doubtful cases, you put society to the expense of a second trial, which really may be unnecessary, and you may put the both parties to the burden of another trial, and you may also let a guilty man go free. There are two sides to all these arguments, it seems to me.
I agree that there are, and I'm not suggesting that the Court should resolve them in a particular way in a particular case. I was using this as an argument to show that in some cases that kind of disposition is a proper one, and indeed perhaps the best one, fairly reflecting the inability to decide whether the evidence technically described under the Glasser standard is sufficient. We've not argued, on the other hand, for a uniform rule that such cases should go back for a second trial. Our argument has been that the Court of Appeals ought to ask a number of questions. The first is whether the evidence that it thought was missing could be supplied at the second trial. Second question is whether there was some reason that it was not supplied at the first trial. The nature of that reason may be very important. The nature
of the reason.
This is still on direct appeal. The nature of the reason why it was not supplied. Excuse me. Let me get back to your question, Mr. Justice Rehnquist. I was not suggesting that the Court of Appeals would itself address those questions.
Well, you say your opponent's argument is a triumph of form over substance. I'm inclined to think yours is a trial of substance over form. If you are going to have every one of these an ad hoc determination by the trial judge as to whether 18 factors have been met or not, this is a rule that's got to be applied by 400 federal trial judges and thousands of state court judges. It's got to have some black and white line drawing character to it.
I think it's difficult, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, to have a clear-cut line in cases like this.
Your brief certainly reveals your feeling to that effect.
One reason for that is because we were starting, at least I was starting here almost by hypothesis, with the class of cases in which it's difficult to make a decision under the Glasser standard. But there are a variety of other cases, I think, in which it's also difficult to make a decision. Those are the classes of cases in which you can't tell whether the error is legal or simple inability to prove the offense. There are many cases in which there's been a reversal, which purportedly is for insufficient evidence, that may have other things underpinning it.
Well, but that's because the court, if I'm tracking you, that's because the court had some other handles to grasp. That is, a motion, an attack on the conviction that was based upon trial errors or pretrial errors and insufficiency of the evidence, and by singling on one of the trial errors, the double jeopardy problem is avoided. But we can't rely on any such distinctions here, can we?
We can't rely on any pretrial errors here. But what I was suggesting, and indeed suggested in response to one of the early questions, was that this may be a case in which it's hard to tell legal rules and factual insufficiency apart. To the extent the Court of Appeals is saying that it believes that the right way to try an insanity case is to ask the point-blank question, was the defendant substantially capable of conforming his conduct?
Well, except that this court, something in the neighborhood of 60 years ago, said that's precisely what you cannot do. That's the question for the jury, and that the questions of at the trial must be directed at furnishing all the bits and pieces from which the jury can draw that inference. That was in the disability case, where the question was, doctor, in your opinion, is the plaintiff totally and permanently disabled? And this court said you can't ask that kind of a question.
The court said that, Mr. Chief Justice, but that decision has been reversed by Federal Rule of Evidence 704. Which was intended
under our new rules of evidence.
Yes.
But I'm talking about the case law. That's what you were addressing yourself to that.
My point was that there was, at least until the time the Sixth Circuit decided this case, an open question of law in that court about whether those questions, in addition to being permissible, were also mandatory. The Court of Appeals now seems to have decided that they are mandatory. But that ultimately is a legal decision and can be described as either a mistake of law on the part of the prosecutor and not having recognized that before trial, or as a failure of proof. I think there are a lot of other examples of that. For example, suppose hearsay evidence is admitted, and the Court of Appeals then concludes that disregarding the improperly admitted hearsay, what's left is insufficient. Is that insufficiency of the evidence or error in admitting the hearsay? Suppose the district court misunderstands some of the elements of the offense and calls on the prosecutor to prove fewer than all of them. Or take a claim of variance between the charge and the proof, which comes up especially often in conspiracy cases. That can be seen either as too little proof of the particular conspiracy charged in the indictment, or too much proof of other conspiracies. Suppose the prosecutor proves an offense, but not the one charged in the indictment. Is that too little proof? Or proof of something else? The examples can go on and on. Critical evidence can be suppressed in mid-trial on Fourth Amendment grounds, and what's left is insufficient. The suppression may be erroneous, raising purely a legal question. Even the questions the prosecutor asks...
Mr. Easterbrook, let me just test your example about the multiple conspiracy versus a single conspiracy, the Katiakis kind of problem. I guess that's what you have in mind. You're saying the trial judge he could either conclude there was not enough evidence to prove the particular conspiracy charge, or alternatively, he could hold that there was prejudicial evidence of a lot of other conspiracies.
Or he may hold both at once.
Well, if he holds the former, why doesn't that entitle the defendant to an acquittal? And if he holds the latter, it's clearly he's entitled to a new trial. Why is that such a complicated case?
The decision of the judge may be, I think you were phrasing them as alternatives. I believe the judge often does both at once. He says, you've proved two conspiracies, not one.
Well, but if he's charged with one and the one charge has not been proved, why should not the man go free simply because an additional error was committed? Isn't that what you're saying?
As the judge's responsibility in that case may be to grant a judgment of acquittal, but suppose he doesn't. Question is, then what happens? Let me come back.
The hypothesis in all of your hypothetical cases, I assume that the trial judge, whatever he should have done, didn't do it. And it went to the jury and there was a conviction and
That's right.
We're on appeal.
Mm-hmm.
Those are your hypotheticals.
Those are all my hypotheticals.
Nothing happened in the trial court except a conviction.
Let me bring back the Foreman case.
Is that on appeal, the appellate court was able to identify the error that it decided required reversal. And if it identified it as a failure of proof, one could say without terrible difficulty that requires acquittal. If he determines that it was prejudice because other conspiracies are proved, it would follow a new trial.
But
isn't that just a matter of deciding the issues?
I think sometimes it's hard to say whether it requires an acquittal. Perhaps the appellate court could conclude with equal accuracy there was really a defect in the framing of the indictment, and that what should have happened is the judge should have mistried the case rather than acquitting.
Then you have
That's
the ball
a, also
case.
A possible
that
conclusion.
That fits right into a neat category, too, doesn't it?
But sometimes it's hard to fit them into neat categories.
A lot of appellate decisions are very, very difficult. But that doesn't mean we dispense with rules, does it?
I'm not suggesting we dispense with rules. I think we've suggested one. But let me try once more with the Foreman case, one that fits in, I think, fairly clearly to your hypothetical, with the added wrinkle that the district judge was wrong. Defendant is charged with income tax evasion. He's charged about 6 years after the return was due to be filed. His contention is that he can't be convicted unless the prosecution proves a subsidiary conspiracy to conceal, because that's the only thing within the statute of limitations. The district judge agrees with him wholeheartedly and charges the jury on a subsidiary conspiracy to conceal argument, a charge that this court determined in Grunewald was erroneous. There was, it turns out, absolutely no evidence to support that charge. If the judge had believed his own legal conclusion, he should have acquitted. If the jury had believed the judge's charge, it should have acquitted. Neither happened. The jury convicted. The Court of Appeals then sent the case back for a new trial under the proper instructions. The defendant's argument was that his right to be acquitted matured at trial when he should have been acquitted. And this court's answer was that it didn't make any difference what should have happened at trial. The fact is that he wasn't acquitted. He was convicted. So his interest in preserving an acquittal, which never took place, simply never came into being.
Yes, but there the same you weren't dealing with a sufficiency of the evidence case. Isn't there a fundamental distinction between reviewing sufficiency of the evidence and reviewing for all other purposes?
Mr. Chief Justice, I think there is an important distinction. The distinction arises because the Double Jeopardy Clause was designed, in part, to prevent the prosecutor from making repeated attempts to assemble and introduce enough evidence to convict a defendant. Defendant has an important interest in avoiding multiple trials where the only difference between one trial and another is the ability or willingness of the prosecutor to introduce probative evidence. But we've submitted that that interest is not enough to prevent a second trial in every event where you might characterize the defect in the first trial as insufficient evidence. Petitioner here, after all, was not acquitted or deprived of his opportunity to be acquitted. He was convicted. Allowing second trials does not provide an incentive for prosecutorial misconduct or overreaching. It would be an exceptional, foolhardy prosecutor who intentionally failed to introduce enough evidence at the first trial, hoping that in the teeth of the lack of evidence, the jury would convict, the Court of Appeals would reverse, and he would have the opportunity to vex the defendant with a second trial. It would be extraordinary. It doesn't happen. The legitimate interests of the defendant do deserve recognition, but they were properly recognized here by the nature of the Court of Appeals remand. This case was not remanded mechanically to hold a second trial. It was remanded to determine why the evidence was insufficient in the first trial. To determine, that is, whether this was a simple failure of the prosecutor to put on evidence that he had, or a simple inability to assemble the evidence, or whether it wasn't instead something more. We think the ends of public justice in a particular case should be the guiding star, whether under the Double Jeopardy Clause or under Section 2106. A second trial is just and appropriate if the first trial was defective because of a mistake of law. Whether or not that mistake ultimately displayed itself in the insufficiency of the evidence. Mistakes of law are too common to permit them to immunize defendants from prosecution, and the interest in accurate resolution of criminal charges outweighs the defendant's interest in uniformly avoiding a second trial. When the evidence is truly insufficient because of prosecutorial neglect or inability to prove the offense, we think that the presumption should be against a second trial. A second trial would be appropriate if, first, it appears that the evidence can be supplied at that trial, at a second trial.
Are you speaking just what the federal rules should be under the statute, or are you talking about a constitutional rule?
We believe that the statutory rule and the constitutional rule should not be any different, Your Honor. That's in part because the Court has said in Jorn and Tateo that the interests of justice determine the constitutional propriety of a second trial, that it's really often a balancing test. And 2106 uses the same language.
So the constitutional rule should be that if the appellate court finds that the evidence was insufficient and there doesn't appear to be any real excuse for it, that the Constitution requires an acquittal.
I believe that that is the correct constitutional rule.
And second, whereabouts is this ultimate determination made? When the man is brought for trial the second time in the district court or in the superior court, whatever the nice surprise court is?
We have not expressed an opinion on that, in part because that's probably most appropriately determined by the courts of appeals in the exercise of their supervisory power to determine where it is most appropriate.
Well, what about the 50 state jurisdictions that are going to be affected by your argument?
I think, too, that those states should have the authority to determine where this kind of determination ought to be made.
But at any rate, you're turning some thousands of nisi prius judges loose to make this ad hoc determination that's a balancing of factors that can come out one way in one case and another way, presumably in a very, very similar case.
Mr. Justice Rehnquist, we hope it's not entirely ad hoc. It's certainly no more ad hoc than finding when, after a mistrial has been declared, there was manifest necessity to do so. And we think
it's
probably...
Well, why compound one sin with another?
We haven't taken the view that one of those, that the manifest necessity argument was a sin.
Mr. Easterbrook, the Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit in this case ended up by adopting the standards and procedure prescribed by the Fifth Circuit in Bass, and there's a concise statement of those standards in its opinion. Are those standards acceptable to and compatible with the position you're arguing here today?
We believe that they are, Your Honor.
It seemed to me that what you said on pages 37 and 38 of your brief were somewhat more complex. Two basic inquiries would be made by the district court on remand under the Bass standard. First of all, was there additional evidence that would be relevant to a verdict? And secondly, whether or not there had been some prosecutorial default in not having presented that evidence at the appropriate time. Now, those two standards would not be too difficult, in my view, for lower courts to apply. I'm thinking of the question that Mr. Justice Rehnquist has asked you.
Your Honor, we don't believe they would be too difficult to apply. I think we were attempting in our brief to take very much the same position and to restate it. The position we stated was whether there was some reason why it didn't come in at the first trial, and that's very much the same as asking whether it was prosecutorial neglect or default, or whether it had some other cause, perhaps a misunderstanding of law, or something other than simple default. I think the standards that we have outlined in our brief are the same as the Bass standards. I think they're the same as
the
Wiley standards.
That is the Bass case in 490 Federal Second?
Yes.
That's from the Fifth Circuit.
Right, the standards that were adopted here. Court of Appeals remanded this case to allow the district court to make those inquiries. Petitioner will not be tried a second time unless the prosecutor can persuade the district court that he has the evidence the Court of Appeals found wanting and that the reason it was not offered was something other than prosecutorial neglect or default. There's no reason to forbid the district court from making those inquiries.
Does that not open a whole new area of appellate review up to now avoided by appellate courts everywhere?
I don't think it does, Your Honor. Appellate courts now are, by and large, making the decision whether to send it back for a new trial, whether to acquit outright, or whether to ask the district court to make that decision. Under 2106, the Court of Appeals has the undoubted power simply to order the defendant acquitted and to stop it there. Since it has that power, it must have some grounds for deciding when to do that and when to do something else. It asks that question now in every case. And we think that the standards we've suggested for asking that question are more helpful to the courts and certainly do not require it to embark on any inquiry that it is not now making. Thank you very much.
Do you have anything further, counsel?
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. I want to give the Chief Justice a better answer to the last question that he asked me. The question was, did I see any alternative between an acquittal and a new trial? I suppose that I would not argue for an absolutist rule here. I think you might find exceptions. The Solicitor General has pointed out some with which I might agree. Some he's pointed out have been where the defendant was prevented, or where the defendant himself prevented the government from going forward. For example, in the Smith 1 case in 1968 in the Sixth Circuit, the defendant in mid-trial interposed the insanity defense, but he wouldn't take it himself, and he wouldn't allow a recess, wouldn't submit to an examination. And the Sixth Circuit said that was his own fault. He shouldn't profit. Of course, that's a well-known principle of law. Counsel for the United States brought up other exceptions, a changing presumption or inference that district court might not be aware of, or variance between the pleading and the proof. And some of those, this court, I don't think is absolutely required in order to decide this case to render such an absolutist opinion. The contours and of this decision might well be left to a later day. But the facts of this case, I think, are such that we're not going anywhere near the limits that he urges. And lastly, Mr. Justice Powell mentioned the Bass rule. And I've mentioned the Smith rule in the Sixth Circuit. Strangely enough, the Sixth Circuit in this case adopted the Bass rule in the Fifth Circuit. But now, as I read the Bass case, that sends it back for a vague balancing of the equities. But the language Bass used is see if the government's got any more evidence they want to use. But we don't want that. We want what they did in 1968 in the Sixth Circuit, what the Sixth Circuit has done before, is see if the government's got a good reason why they didn't use the evidence. Not only if they just got more evidence, but A, if they got more evidence, and B, is there some good reason why they didn't do that? So we certainly don't agree with the Bass decision at all. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.